All right, welcome everyone. Welcome to our panel today. My name is Tao Li, and I'm a partner at Pepper Hamilton in the Corporate Securities Practice Group, and I'll be your MC today. I'm also the unfortunate person of standing between you and the wine tasting reception, along with these ladies, but they are very much worth it. They are a very dynamic group of women, as you can see so far. But a little bit about Pepper Hamilton. We are incredibly proud to be a sponsor of the Pennsylvania Women's Conference. As you can see and have probably experienced throughout the day, that this is a very unique and special organization and conference. It truly is a conference that inspires women to take ownership of their personal and professional development and to really make their mark. And more importantly, it encourages companies to do better for the diverse workforce that supports them. At Pepper Hamilton, we have over 425 lawyers in 14 offices, and we are truly committed to the advancement of diverse lawyers. In fact, we're one of the few firms that can proudly claim that we're Mansfield certified. And what does that mean? It means that we have adopted recruiting and promotion processes that ensures that at least 30% of potential candidates for leadership positions, advancements, and client pitch teams are comprised of women, lawyers of color, and lawyers who are members of the LGBT community. You may think that 30% is a low bar, but believe me, it's a very high bar for the legal industry, who has not been known to be diverse. And so we are incredibly proud to be partnering with the Pennsylvania Women's Conference and to show our commitment to the advancement of women. Today, I'd like to thank you for joining our breakout session, which is How Bias is Affecting Your Organization. As I mentioned before, we have a dynamic group of women that are going to be leading this conversation. I would say that they are the thought leaders in leadership and inclusion. Leading this panel will be Dr. Tiffany Janna. Tiffany is the founder of TMI Consulting, a diversity and inclusion management firm. Under her guidance, her firm has become a global leader in social enterprise and values-based engagement that nurtures talent while making a positive impact in the world. She has published numerous articles on the topic of diversity and inclusion, and I can't think of a better person to lead this panel. Joining Tiffany is Trey Boynton, who is a senior manager, and this is a very popular title that she has, and very detailed.
Just say it.
She is the Solution Design and Development Global Strategy and Enterprise Solutions Office of Inclusion and Collaboration at Cisco Systems. Did I get it right?
Yeah.
This card is like this long.
It's really obnoxious. I'm so sorry.
It's very impressive, you know, for an impressive lady. Then we also have Jennifer Brown, who's the founder of Jennifer Brown Consulting and author of How to Be an Inclusive Leader. And rounding out the panel is Quinetta Robinson, who is a Fred J. Springer Endowed Chair of Business Leadership at the Villanova School of Business. We'll learn a little bit more about the remaining panelists, but for now, please join me in welcoming the panel.
All right. Good afternoon, y'all.
Good afternoon.
So good to see your shining, smiling faces. Thank you for joining us in this, the best session of the entire conference, right?
Yeah.
We've done it before, so we can say that that's in fact true. So yes, I'm Dr. Tiffany Janna. My pronouns are they and them. I'm gender nonconforming, but I'm happy to be here at this women's conference because a great many people experience me as woman, and I only just changed that last year. Thank you, millennials, for the choices you've given me in my life.
Woohoo!
So my first two books were Overcoming Bias and Erasing Institutional Bias. I'm telling you this because this is my third time talking today, and I forgot to tell people they are going to be on sale in the bookstore, and there is a signing after this at 4 p.m., and Jennifer and I will both be signing our titles, so join us there. But it is a great honor to be with you today. I love this conference so much. It has given me a great deal of learning, and I've gotten a lot of value out of it over the years, and it's a real privilege to be able to speak here. Before we set off on course to have our fantastic and exhilarating panel discussion, I just want to frame a few things up for you from the front here. And to the gentleman in the back from Merck, who's already seen me, forgive me for repeating myself, right? You'll have extra learning. You'll get more than 60% remembered. So one of the things that I wanted to share with you is that there's a paradigm, an analogy that I've been using for diversity, equity, and inclusion that I think is really important as we consider taking on this work or expanding this work in the workplace. And that is is the idea that if you go back 40 years and you think about information systems and information technology, if you had a person, and I say a person on purpose, not a guy, right? If you had a person, maybe in the basement, who was an IT person, you might call that person up if something broke to fix it. And 40 years ago, that was advanced. Like if there was a person with anything technical in their title, that was a thing, right? Fast forward 20, 25 years, and what happens? We've recognized as leaders that if we integrate information systems and information technology into everything that we do in business, it accelerates the pace at which we do business, and it fundamentally shifts the way we're able to do business. We are all currently benefiting from the full integration of information systems and information technology into the way we do business. It's changed everything. I believe diversity, equity, and inclusion is exactly the same. If you embed DEI values across everything in your organization, it can serve as the same kind of force accelerator, okay? That means that any key performance indicator that you can identify, I can link it back to diversity, equity, and inclusion and show you how you can accelerate your goals. That is real. Right now, what we're experiencing is an old paradigm that needs to be shifted. Diversity is often relegated to Taco Tuesdays, that council over there, or that person who happens to have a marginalized identity who was dubbed diversity human. Right? Right? How do you think I got here? Just kidding. So that's really problematic, and you're pretty much guaranteed to not have success if you leave, you know, if you leave your diversity off to its own devices and no one's empowered and they don't know what they're doing. So three things to guarantee that your effort will in fact fail. I like to tell you how to fail, because failing we're so good at. So here's how to fail at diversity. One, failure to get enough buy-in from senior leadership. Top of the organization has to be bought in. And if it's not one of your top three initiatives, you might not want to even take it on. Top five is my absolute lowest, okay? Top three to five, it's got to be up there. If it's not, for the love of all things holy, don't even start, because it's not going to succeed. Second, failure to define clear and measurable goals. I can't help my clients win if you don't tell me what winning looks like. What are we trying to accomplish here? If we need to calibrate that together, that's something that my organization, Jennifer's organization, we can help you do that. But you've got to define what success is. Otherwise, we never get there. And we're still swimming in these diversity waters, and we're not going anywhere, and we're going in a big old circle. It's not cute. All right. Third is the failure to embed accountability. So I don't care if you're the CEO. I don't care if you're the rainmaker that's making all the rain monies fall down. If you have defined the behaviors that define the new culture for the inclusive organization that you want, and people can still behave any old kind of way and commit any old kind of, you know, inappropriate, you know, acts or, you know, harassment or microaggressions, whatever it is, but they're never held accountable to the new standard, then your effort is weak. It has no teeth. And it's probably a sham. Fair enough? Sweet. All right, quick question. Please raise your hand if you identify as a good person. Identify as a good person, aspiring to be a good person. I'll give you that. Fine, great. Okay. All right, so today we're going to talk about unconscious bias and bias in the workplace. And the reason that I wanted to find out who's a good people is because, by and large, those of us who identify as good people don't really get a kick out of hurting people's feelings and generally treating people badly. If you're one of those, we'll have a side conversation later, okay? But if we're identifying as good people, we're not intentionally setting out to cause harm. Unconscious bias and the biases that affect how we operate as humans, it's just part of our hardwiring. Our brains take shortcuts. It doesn't make you bad. It doesn't make you wrong. It doesn't make you evil. It makes you human. Please do not, here's what not to do again, do not walk out of these doors today and say, hey, I'm not biased. I don't know what the crazy blue-haired person was talking about, but I ain't got none of that. Garbage! If you are breathing, you have bias, okay? If you don't have bias, and if you say that, you're gonna make a fool out of yourself, and you're also gonna embarrass me, and my value will go down. Don't do it. So we all have bias. The deal is that we might not recognize the nature of unconscious bias. You don't know that you have it. So we actually have to do work to figure out what those biases are, okay? And there's lots of different ways you can figure that out, like reading Overcoming Bias, a book might be. Got all kinds of tips for how to do that. Won't get into that now. But you've got to do that, because if you are, particularly if you know that you are in a position of power where you're affecting people's livelihood, their position, their compensation, whether or not they're going to be hired, you've got to be able to suspend your own judgment. You've got to be able to disrupt your own bias and allow that person who is in front of you to be who they are. Because 99.999% of the biases and the opinions that you have about humanity and various demographics come from old stuff that either happened to you and had nothing to do with the person in front of you, or come from really crappy messaging from the people who loved you the most and were trying to turn you into these good people, right? Your parents, your clergy, your teachers. People thought they were giving you good messages. They might not still be useful. And the responsible, compassionate adult thing to do at this time is to take responsibility for what is on your hard drive and be an intentional human being who moves through the world in a good way. Fair enough? Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk to these panelists.
Well done.
Awesome sauce. All right. So I'm going to, I know we got a little bit of introduction, but I want to give each of you guys like a minute or so to go a little bit deeper into what you do and why you were selected for this panel, because Penn Women Conference is so amazing at picking the best people ever. So I'm going to start all the way on the other end with Quinetta. Quinetta Robertson Connolly, professor and endowed chair. Tell us why you're on this panel today, darling.
Oh, why?
So rather than restate my bio, here I'll tell you how I got here.
Perfect.
I started my career as a banker. For those of you who are from the area, Core States Bank. I was a financial analyst, and the bank actually had a diversity initiative. Now, this was revolutionary because this was the early 90s,
ooh,
right? That's when we just started hearing the term diversity. But if you are also from the area, you know, right around that time, Core States was going through a right-sizing, so they were looking for people to voluntarily leave. And I asked myself two questions: what am I best at and what I love? The answer to both of those were school. I tried to think how I could be in school for the rest of my life. Eureka, I'll be a professor.
Yes.
And so I went to school to get my PhD, et cetera. But people say that we study our lives. And I wanted to understand this diversity thing a bit more because I had seen people's interactions, saw what worked and what didn't work, and I wanted to explore that. The other thing was in talking to people from companies, one of the things I would be willing to bet you money that somewhere in the first 5 minutes, they would tell me how many of X they had in leadership or on their board, and or they would tell me how many awards they won. And my question was always, so what? So I wanted to find out the so what. What was the impact? Why did it even matter? And so I decided to study these issues so that I could not only write about it, but then also inform companies, inform organizations from an evidence-based perspective of how to do this better.
Beautiful.
And so that's how I'm here.
Thank you. All right, next up, Jennifer Brown, author, CEO, and consultant.
Consultant, yes. How did I get here? We study our lives. That is so true.
Yeah.
I'm trying to change workplaces where I didn't feel that I could bring my full self to work. And so the legacy I want to have is that I improve that for future generations of talent. Identify as a LGBTQ woman. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm trying to build that muscle where I say that.
Thank you.
And I was closeted. I was also an opera singer before I did any of this. So I came to New York not knowing anyone, wanted to make it. Unfortunately injured my voice and had a couple surgeries. So I literally lost my voice. So, you know, aside from like needing to reinvent, what I reinvented into makes some kind of cosmic sense, which is, you know, that I would now be dedicating my life to building a workplace where all of us could be welcomed, valued, respected, and heard. And that's been really poignant for me. And I like to say I was meant to use my voice, just not as a singer.
Awesome.
It was really deep. But the other, I was like, oh, okay, I got it now. Whenever the universe takes something away, it's like, no, not this, but this. And I felt very redirected. And subsequently, my team is all over the country. It's an amazing group of consultants that I work, learn from every day. We serve the Fortune 1000, and we build diversity and inclusion strategy. So I cut my teeth on ERGs, affinity groups. That's where I started as a tiny little team and a consultant. And then we built upwards into the strategy that includes ERGs. We went into training, like unconscious bias training, inclusive leader training. And now I'm a second-time author, which is super cool. I also really think my voice is uniquely needed in this conversation. Where I've come to is Kimberly Crenshaw's intersectionality, of course, talks about the overlapping stigmatized identities that are experienced, for example, by women of color, a queer woman, for example. So some of us are dealing with multiple identities and kind of trying to navigate a tricky walk through a workplace where we don't see anyone that looks like us. For me, you know, I have all these privileged identities that I've got to figure out what to do with as well that weren't earned by me. So where I've landed is I need allyship as an LGBTQ woman and as a woman, and my male allies are so important to me, and my straight allies are so important to me. But I can also be an ally, like use my voice to get into rooms, to speak truth to power, to challenge decision makers, and somehow, not fairly, but be an insider with the things that I have that make me an insider and be able to be heard differently. So now that I have that, I sort of understand my role. And I would urge all of you to think about privilege that we all have of some kind, even as we have maybe marginalized identities, and think about what we can be doing. And I have found that really animating and energizing. And it helps me speak to the largely white and male audiences I speak to, because they don't know how they connect into any of this. They really, really don't. It's not that they're bad people. I'm well-intended, I don't see color, I believe in equality, I have daughters, we go through all the things. And then I'm like, but you know, intent is not enough to shift workplace cultures. Right. Leaders need to be uncomfortable on a regular basis. They should be stretching themselves, they should be stepping out of their comfort zone. I think those leaders should be telling their diversity stories, as vulnerable as those might be. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of those kinds of walk in the woods with Jennifer sort of things. Like, it's in there, I know it's in there. And so, yeah, it's just a really interesting time to be a diversity consultant that looks like me. It's a great, there's an openness now that I've never seen. Well, I don't know about you, but.
The lexicon of our trade is part of the common vernacular. I've been doing this work for 20 years, and is like 5-6 years ago, people be like, oh, what do you do? I'm like, oh, diversity and inclusion. They're like, what? What's that? Now everyone's like, oh my God, it's a great time to do diversity. I'm going, well. Yeah, it always was,
We've been waiting.
Thank you for joining, and I'm happy to have all of these allies.
Right? True.
All right, so Trey Boynton, we're not going to give the whole big giant card, but we're going to say builder of inclusion solutions.
Yeah, that's what I do in my day job. So kind of how did I end up here? I think similar, I'm from higher education. I'm a recovering academic. So we probably just swapped. I worked in college student affairs for almost 20 years at the University of Michigan. Go blue?
Hmm? Yes.
There's always one. But part of what was really transformative during that time was I studied college student development. And part of that was really in studying how college students come to the university, come to a college, a collegiate setting. What is the opportunity? And I thought it was a fantastic way to do equity, inclusion, intergroup dialogue, and that's where I'm grounded in that pedagogy of how do we talk about difference? How do we talk within, through, across, leverage, all of that stuff? But I was doing it with 18 to 24-year-olds, really was my main, that was my constituency. And so when, for me, right, we are the work, we do the work that we are, intergroup dialogue and really identity development was seminal in my awareness of my own journey. I had a really interesting collegiate experience. I studied abroad in Europe for a year. I was a French major. Yeah, that's what I tell college students all the time. It doesn't matter what you study, you're fine. And then I went to an historically black all women's college. I went to Spelman. Any Spelmanites out here? I knew it. I saw you and we had eye contact and I don't know how.
We're just having a reunion up here, don't mind us.
My Spelman sister. So Spelman for me was groundbreaking. Oh, I'm so happy we had this moment. Give us just a minute. And I just hugged Ava DuVernay. This day is epic. What is happening? People are texting me because I've been on my, whew. Anyway, so part of that was I went to Spelman and then I went to Georgetown, and those really two disparate experiences for me were like, whoa, this is weird and different, and let me figure out why. And I learned that in my graduate program with identity development, black identity, queer identity, just student identity, white identity development, like all of the stuff of how you are navigating otherness is really fascinating to me. And so I spent time doing that. And then I got this opportunity to join this little quirky startup in Ann Arbor. that was called Duo Security by a leader who had all the qualifications that you just outlined. Mm. I would argue that he was the first chief diversity officer because he baked it in the company. He baked it in the values of we gotta do different, we gotta be awesome. Different, we have to look different. Security specifically has a place in this. And he said, we need to hire someone at 400 employees. And they hired me. And I was like, what do you mean? I'm not supposed to be in tech. That's funny. That's so funny. And everybody was saying, Trey, you should apply for this job. It's around the corner. And I think I didn't see myself in tech. I thought I had to be a coder. And that was it. Like, those are the only two jobs in tech. I'm so, oh gosh, me, myself, and I'm like helping myself be better, right? Because I just, you can't see what you can't be. Mm-hmm. And then when they let me in the door and I said, well, I want to build something kind of like radical and kind of community organizing, and I want our diversity strategy to be built on social justice and allyhood. And they were like, okay, go. And I was like, wait, what? I didn't know y'all were gonna say yes. And they did, and wow. we did. And our ERGs were based off of allyhood, and it was based off of issues. And so what we built before we were acquired by Cisco was really this kind of radical notion that it takes everyone, it takes a collectivist model to actually change the world and to change companies and to change industries. And that's why I think I'm sitting here, because I did something kind of kooky at Duo that Cisco didn't hate. And Cisco said, hey, can you do something kooky for us? And then that's why they gave me that long title.
Nice. Wow, thank you. Yeah. That was awesome. So now I just want to fit in. So I have at least 5 intersectional identities. You probably can tell I'm a person of color, for those of you who can't see color. Just gotta say it. So gender nonconforming, right? I have an invisible disability. I suffer with anxiety and depression. And if nobody has ever heard of GeneSight, everybody said, somebody said, take notes today. GeneSight. This is my plug for anyone you know with mental health challenges. It's a DNA test that you can take that will help you identify which medications you should and should not take. Changed my life. I'm not on a pharmaceutical anymore. I have been suicidal ideation free for 4 years because I came off of the meds. So GeneSight. LGBTQ, and I'm missing one. I can't. Can you all tell which ones did I say? I said gender, race, invisible disability, LGBT. There's something else that I can't even remember. I have to do diversity work, right? Because so many identities I can't even remember. I've counted 5 or 6, but I'm actually doing what most people on the planet do, and that is I am doing what my parents do. My mother was a pioneer in the field, and she was standing up offices of multicultural affairs in universities, and I'm basically doing what my mama did. All right, so thank you. I just wanted to fit in with you guys because you guys are so cool. So let's see, Trey. You just blew my mind. Like, that was so amazing. Talk to me about this allyhood and how that shows up in interrupting bias. So we're trying to help people who are navigating this space within their work in their workplaces. And you mentioned the allyhood piece.
Yeah. So I think you talked about allyhood too. And like, what does allyhood look like? Yeah, and I think part of it is, I have some choices I get to make on a daily basis. And part of what my upbringing, my diversity upbringing brought me, is this idea of marginalization and privilege, right? Of that in places and the identities that I hold as a queer woman of color, that's what I say. I kind of use that as a whole term. I can't unhook those because I'm constantly navigating those. But I have a whole bunch of 7 other, there are 10 social identity categories, y'all. Mm. I'm a first generation college student. I'm a US citizen. I'm able-bodied. I am agnostic, but lean towards Christianish holidays just because they're around. There's places where I hold a lot of ease, and I think privilege is hard to talk about because it's about I was given stuff I didn't earn, and I'm benefiting from a system that was built, but I didn't try for it. I'd like to reject it, but I can't because the system's just so easy. I like to think about it as ease. I don't have to use bandwidth to navigate the world around my ability to walk into an airport, breeze right on through and not get frisked. I don't have to worry about the time that it takes to get out of bed during the seasons in Michigan where it gets really cold, y'all, where someone who has seasonal affective disorder has to struggle to get out of bed, right? Like I just get to go. Now, on the other hand, on my other identities, I have to think about it. I have to think about if I want to come out and tell them and use the term fiance and have people, do I tell them about the extra E or not? Right? Do I say she and use her pronouns? When I walk into a room and someone says, oh, you went to Georgetown. Interesting. And they're surprised. because of how I looked. When I ask, you know, because I think that's what bias is. Yeah. That's how bias shows up. It's because I want to put you in a category, and right, it's natural, it happens. Okay, we've all agreed. Part of allyhood, I think, is what am I actively doing around the stuff that's not my jam mm-hmm. that I'm going to do for others? Because I'm asking other people to ally for me. I'm asking men to step up and not say guys when you're introducing a group of anybody. How about you step up and say, who are we looking at? When I'm thinking actively about my group, my initiative, who am I looking at around the room? Who has voice? Who has initiative? When I'm thinking about white folks, when people are telling you that they are in pain because of racism, mm-hmm. how about you just believe them? Mm. Let's just start there.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, please. How about you just believe us? Yes. And actually not try to argue with us that we're not telling the full truth. How about you not take it personally? When, straight folks, we are trying to tell you it's not just about marriage, believe us that it's not just about marriage. We still have a bunch of stuff to do, and our trans sisters, trans brothers are out here struggling for their lives.
And dying.
Yeah. And dying at rates that would make your skin crawl. So when I do that from my own identity, it's easy for me to ask for help. I have to show up for the other communities where I have access, where I have power, where I have ease. And that's where allyhood shows up. I've got to constantly get into the habit of repeating the question, who am I missing? What am I missing? What am I not seeing? And where are we going wrong here? Yes. Mm-hmm. Who could be hurt by this? Who could be impacted by this? That's my role as an ally, because I always think that it's interconnected. This is Stacey Ann Chen's work. All oppression is connected. When I start pulling on the thread of sexism and I start pulling on the thread of racism, and you're over there pulling a couple threads and you're publishing a couple threads about the other stuff and you're over here giving strategy, it's all gonna meet in the middle, y'all. It's gonna unravel one day. I inherently am hopeful about that because I gotta hunker down on hope these days, y'all.
Amen, sister.
And so that's why I think allyhood is critical, because it is the act of repetitive, inclusive behavior saying, I know I'm biased here, what am I missing? That's where allyhood, and I gotta show up in the places that it's not about me.
So you totally made me remember my other identity.
Yay! What is it?
English was not my first language.
Boom.
It's hard for me to remember that. Spanish was my first language. Goodness. I have no Hispanic or Latinx heritage whatsoever. I was just born in El Paso, Texas, right on the border, and my friends and babysitters.
We're all supposed to speak
Spanish. My mother was like, she comes home and I'm speaking Spanish, and she's like, what, my baby? I'm like, where were you?
All right, so Quinetta, so we're talking about unconscious biases relating to gender and race and all these other things, but you had something to say about biases that might not be on our radar yet.
Yeah, I mean, we often go to the biases that are based on things that people see, but you know, there's so many other biases and that are baked into the culture of organizations. So, you know, if you think about the traditional leadership profile in a lot of organizations, which is very type A, and so if you are not a go-getter, aggressive, unemotional, all of those things, you may not be seen as a leader, right? And so that becomes a bias for how people see you. Or what's the book, Quiet, right? So thinking about the power of introverts, where people who talk louder, who talk more, are sometimes seen more as leaders. So it can be, you know, personality things, it can be interaction styles, it can be work styles. So, you know, if you think about, I call them like biorhythms of the day. People want to call an 8 o'clock meeting. I don't want to be there, right? As Elizabeth Gilbert said, I don't care, right?
I don't care.
It's not that, so people will say like, oh, you like to sleep in. No, I just don't like being yanked into the day, right? I want to ease into my day because I'm better later in the day. I'm actually really good at night. But you know, so thinking when people are always planning meetings early on in the morning, or thinking about, you know, the way people's perspective, people often say, let's take a 50,000 foot view on this, right? That person may be considered too big picture, that they don't know how to do analyses or they don't know about details. But then you have somebody who's so in the details and people are like, well, that person's in the weeds. And so these biases can be generated based on anything. You literally can come up with a bias based on any kind of group membership. And I'll give you a personal example. I was in the speaker's lounge talking to a couple of people, and someone said, they were talking to each person and they said, you know, do you have a book? And everybody was talking about their books, right? And then they looked at me, they were like, do you have a book? And I was like, no. And they were like, right? Bias.
Now, throw the
book. It just happens to be 25 chapters of theory and research. Nobody's going to read it. But, you know, but again, you can come up with a bias on anything. And so being able to kind of meet people where they are and figure out how they are interpreting those interactions and those work styles and those behaviors becomes really important.
Yeah, I think a lot of organizations fall back on, well, this is the way we've always done it, or this is the profile of a banker, this is the profile of whatever, and those profiles and those assumptions and those biases are often unchecked and unexamined, and it's like taking time to pull some things back and figure out where did this come from and is it even useful? And are they, and this is where we look at like structural barriers to inclusion, because like we look at people's like handbooks, employee handbooks, and you can have things that are written in ways that are exclusive. You can have whole rules and policies that make absolutely no sense. Like the whole idea that anybody doesn't have parental leave, hello, paternity leave, leave for people who make other people and want to take care of them. You're just gonna assume that because it pops out of you, you gotta be the one to go home? Like, come on now. I wanna go back to work, I don't know about y'all. So Jennifer, I wanted to see if you would talk to us a little bit about covering behavior, because sometimes if you are the person with the marginalized identities, as much as our world might be encouraging people to live out loud and more authentically, it's not easy.
No. So Covering was a book that was written by Kenji Goshino, and then they did a report with Deloitte called Uncovering Talent, and I really would recommend you read it. For me, it gave a name to what I still do when I walk that line of disclosing who I am, things I can disclose, things I can't avoid disclosing. You know, I'll walk in the room and, like we were talking about, what stereotype is triggered immediately? And then if there are other diverse identities going on, what can I hide? So for being LGBTQ, it's interesting, you know, no one ever guesses I'm LGBTQ when I step on the keynote stage. And so it's a really great moment to pry open people's assumptions about who they think I am. And they're shocked that I'm their diversity speaker, right? Because they just don't picture that I would know anything about diversity, which is really fascinating. And I think that's an object lesson in terms of those in the organization who I think we haven't known how to talk to some people about what this means to them. So you'd walk by me on the street and assume I knew nothing about diversity. You know, I spend most of my time in white male executive rooms, and I might have in the old days walked into that room and said, none of these people know anything about this, like, and I'm here to teach them. And that's largely still true. bless their hearts. However, when I invite the conversation around covering behaviors, and whether it's socioeconomic background, alcoholic, abusive childhood, single parent, disability in their family, being married to somebody of a different ethnicity, or having children that nobody knows are yours, and like walking through life that way, religious diversity. So I hear just these amazing stories. And so it's taught me that to have a commitment, which is that everyone has a diversity story. I need to believe this because I need the whole organization to participate in this. You know, I think that we're in a danger of having sort of siloed conversations amongst our affinity groups and ERGs, and those are so important. But allyship cross group and cross identity, like you were just referencing, is how we're going to move forward. So there was a huge scandal. I don't know if anyone remembers last year, Deloitte allegedly canceled their ERGs. Does anybody remember this?
I remember that. Mm-hmm.
And I was quoted in the article saying, until such time as people feel safe bringing their full selves to work, we're gonna need single identity spaces. Yeah. So because some of us, half of LGBTQ people are closeted in the workplace, half of us. And this is a statistic from last year. So no matter how many great policies you have, blah, 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 you're winning all the awards, and half of your LGBT employees are closeted. Like, how can you reconcile that? Well, it's your workplace culture. It's how it feels every day to be me in the workplace. It's, does anyone raise the issues of the day around me? Like Pulse nightclub shooting, for example. How many CEOs and colleagues, and maybe you, you're sitting there thinking, gosh, it never occurred to me I might want to ask how someone's doing when that happened, because we're so used to not bringing our full self to work, we're so used to leaving it at the door. Similarly, with all the police shootings over the last couple of years, I think companies have struggled. They're like, how do we talk about this do we talk about it? Is it a slippery slope? Because we talk about this, and then we talk about that, and then we need to address this, and like, where does it end, right? That's, to me, that's kind of a way of resisting the whole conversation. It's not the right answer. You know, I think companies should be communicating about issues that affect their employees outside of the four walls of the company. Like, we shouldn't be denying that the world is going on outside of the company, right? That's what we mean when we say bring our full selves to work. So I think we're really at this interesting moment where the executive level is struggling to keep up with this conversation. I think they're the learners in this scenario. We're the teachers. And millennial and Gen Y talent are the teachers as well. And the ERGs are the teachers. Because our companies literally need us and our intelligence and our cultural experience. They are terrified. They're gonna get a marketing campaign wrong. They don't have the right people at the table. That's us. Like, we need to be at that table. So it's nothing short of literally like business viability. Like, if we're not involved, we can't inform strategy. We can't give our input. We can't say, you know, those two women in our ad for LGBT people, like, they really look like mother and daughter. They don't look like wives. Oh my gosh. You know? Yeah. Like, we notice these things. Mm-hmm. So if we're not at the table, we can't kind of explore that nuance and save the company a heap mm-hmm. of money and embarrassment. Mm-hmm. You know, like the PepsiCo ad with the Kardashian and the Black Lives Matter march. Google it. They pulled it 24 hours later. My question was, where were the employee resource groups? Like, you know, Renee Meyer says, diversity is being asked to the dance and inclusion is being asked to dance. So both of those things need to be present. You can't just be at the table but have no voice. You need right. to be at the table, have a voice, be listened, be heard, and be listened to mm-hmm. is the sort of 3.0 of it. So
there's a phenomenon that I've noticed in the last few years of doing diversity work for a living, and that is that until recently, 100% of the work was instigated or initiated at a higher level, not necessarily the CEO, but talent management, human resource director, somewhere higher up in the organization. Someone made a decision that they were going to do something related to diversity, right? In the past few years, the vast majority of the work is coming from the lowest levels of the organization. Like individual contributors, younger folks coming in are walking into these organizations and saying, oh, hey, this is not really inclusive. This is not working for me. And by the way, I know that there are people who can help us get this right. And hey, by the way, boss, management, supervisors, people, y'all need to do something about this. This is a responsibility. And it's remarkable because sometimes it's folks who are still within the organization and they're, you know, making the noise and building allies, and there's enough people holding hands going up to management like, what you gonna do? Right? Mm-hmm. But we also get it on the exit interviews. They're losing key personnel, yes. people of color, LGBT people, women, who upon the exit interview are saying, great organization, would love to stay here, but y'all don't have your diversity ducks in a row, so I'm out. And upon that exit, people are calling for support because they're hearing it more than once.
Yeah. I think that's so important to notice, right? Because you can have the right product, you can have the right strategy, you can have brilliant people around you. What's the difference between you and every other company? Culture. And in the quote-unquote war on talent, right? Mm-hmm. I don't love war analogies, but it's like there's competition for talent. Talent can go anywhere. Part of what your differential is culture, mm-hmm. belonging, connectedness, authenticity, the ability to show up as me, mm-hmm. right? And I know there's like this Peter Drucker quote, right? It's like, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast. Mm-hmm. I would like to put a little addendum on the front of it that says, you know, if culture eats strategy for breakfast, then inclusion sets the table. You don't even have a table. You can't even have breakfast unless inclusion is literally the tablecloth. That's right. And that's what I think is important.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, ladies, very much for the amazing insights that you have and the expertise that you have today. Let's give them a round of applause right now. So we're actually going to open this up to audience questions. And so if you have any questions, start thinking about them, and you may want to start lining up to the mics. But before we actually open it up to the floor, and since I'm the MC, I get to ask the first question. This is why I really volunteered to do this job. You know, you've given a lot of great stories and insights, and you're really living the stuff on the front line. And I think that everybody here could probably raise their hand and say, well, I had that too, and I had that too. But I think one of the more important things that I'd like to see is, like, maybe you can summarize, like, your top two or three tips as to how we can overcome bias, whether it's overcoming bias on an individual level or on an institutional level. So, you know, why don't we start down with you, Tiffany?
Sure. All things related to diversity, equity, and inclusion work need to start with you. Don't focus initially externally, focus on yourself. And even though I've written 4 books and the 4th one comes out in March and is available for pre-order on Amazon now, I'm going to recommend 2 books not by me. White Fragility is a good book by Robin DiAngelo. White folks and black folks and everyone else should read that book. It's a really gracious treatment of the things that are really hard to talk about. And Ibram X. Kendi's 2nd book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Those 2 books, start there and then see what happens.
Yeah, I think it's specifically on the topic of bias. We've moved away from unconscious bias as how we talk about it as a company, and we're talking about bias mitigation. Like it's an action. It's not a noun. Right. It's an action. You have to mitigate. You have to work. It means work. You have to work at it.
I would say consider whatever conversations you can have that may be more risky for somebody else to have, and be the one that offers to have them. Let me say something to that person, or hey, did you feel heard in that meeting? And also ask for allyship. You know, I think a lot of allies are shocked that what they're doing is actually helpful. I have found that they're like, "What do you mean? I could do a lot more of that if I knew that it was helping." So I think that allies are waiting to be directed and want to do a good job and want to be enlisted. I just think they're clueless. Especially if they're a good leader anyway, they're like, well, this is just regular stuff that I do. And you can point out and say, no, it's actually you enabled me to feel heard, and you had my back, and you did this, and you did that. And that leader's gonna say, thank you for making that visible to me. Let me do more of it, and then let me hold my colleagues accountable for doing the same thing, right? So we have to start with one and hope that they sort of leverage and teach and hold each other accountable, because we can't do all the work. We have to work smarter, not harder. We've got to work through our allies, because we're going to burn ourselves out if we don't. So really think strategically about who has your back, who's doing this for you, and then practice doing it for others, because that's really where we have to go both ways.
So I teach the MBAs at Villanova, and actually it's... Those are actually my students right there.
They just got extra credit.
That's right. But one of the great things is that they come to class after work, right? And so when I teach, they want to know how what we're talking about applies to what they did today or what they have to do tomorrow. So I give them things that they can actually put into practice. And so, you know, if you think about bias, it typically comes because people have had a pattern of experience behavior that they are used to. So you've got to break the pattern, disrupt the pattern in their mind in order to overcome the bias. Now, here's the thing. There is research that shows that if people become aware of their biases, they just become aware of their biases. Mm-hmm. Yeah, doesn't change anything. They're like, oh, I'm biased? Okay. Right? They just talking about their biases. The other thing is that we work with adults, right? People are pretty much who they are. And so there's nothing that I'm going to do that's going to change the way that person thinks. I can only change the way they see things. So the way I think about it is when I spot some kind of a bias, then I look for an opportunity to change the narrative. I think about what I want them to know, and then I give them some piece of novel information. And so it then that disrupts that pattern. And so I'll give you a quick example. At our reception last night, a career coach came up to me and a friend of mine, and she introduced herself. She said, I'm a career coach, and you know, I help people who may be stuck in their career. Perhaps you're not where you would want to be right now. And she gave me this whole spiel, and I let it go. And then she said, you know, and I tried to tell people X, Y, and Z, and I said, that's the same thing I tell my students. And she said, what grade do you teach? And I said, MBA grade. And she said, and you could see this, right? And I was like, I'm a professor at Villanova. But what I wanted to do was I spotted the opportunity. I told her what I wanted her to know, and I gave her that piece of novel information, which changed what she thought about me. So in a way, I owned my narrative. O-W-N, the opportunity, what you want them to know, and the novel information. I wasn't at Target the day they was handing out degrees.
Amazing. I love it.
That's the way.
I love it. Oh, yay. Questions.
Great.
Hi, my name is this one?
It is.
Yes.
I'm usually loud, so I can't tell when it's the microphone. Hi, my name is Heather Kay. I'm a senior director of talent management. So to your point, yeah, a lot of this started with us, but it's so great to see you really disseminated. Mm-hmm. Leadership development is one of the groups that's underneath me. And one of the things that I try to employ on our leaders is, to your point, you need to do something different. Having an awareness is great. So when I think of diversity, you had mentioned kind of the introverts, extroverts. I say to our leaders, when you're having a brainstorming, it's not just saying, all right, guys, let's go and start writing things on the whiteboard. It's say, give everybody 5 minutes, let them think about it, so that when you go around the room, the introverts and the extroverts have the same opportunity to share. And I find that giving leaders, and especially not the great ones, something specific to do.
Yes. I was like,
Someone wrote a book.
Yeah, oh my God, the new book.
I'm just gonna jump down here.
Oh, she's got, oh, look.
How to be an inclusive leader. It's everything you ever wanted to know. You can take a picture though. But true, am I right?
But yes. It's like so hard to boil down like the
yeah.
It's a lot. One or two. So in my book, there's a four-part model: unaware, aware, active, and advocate. Because I sensed that people didn't know where they were in their own journey. And it was very clear to me, as somebody that's trying to help them, but they couldn't see themselves. And then people just love to know where they are. So in aware, which is phase two, it's, oh my goodness, I can't believe I used to say I don't see color, for example. It's like that dawning awareness of what's right and wrong. It's also, gee, I thought women loved working for me, and I had tons of women. We don't have a pay gap, and I have daughters, so I understand gender equality. All that. Once you can get to aware, it's like, wait a second. Like, I've been telling myself I'm a good person, and I have really good intentions, but it is not mattering at all what I'm actually doing. So that mindset shift is really important. And then once that happens, then there's tons of shame and like, oh my goodness, I didn't know. I can't believe I didn't know. So sometimes it's holding the space for that, but saying at the same time, like, okay, now that you know that you don't know, what I do as an ally is I endeavor, this is very specific, I put myself in rooms where I'm the only person of my identity.
Yeah.
All the time. Your ARGs and ERGs are a great place to do this. Mm-hmm. You must make sure you're uncomfortable on a regular basis. I don't care how you define that. For me, it's being an outsider in insider conversations mm-hmm. and knowing what that feels like and having the cultural humility to pick up on the language that's being used by a community that's not mine. Yep. I say Latinx now. I don't say Hispanic. Like, adjustment. I don't say, I use different, I'm always adjusting my language through the podcasts I listen to, the movies that I watch. It would be so easy for me to just listen to people that look like me in my media consumption. Stories about people that look like me, podcasts by people that look like me, but I really intentionally make time to learn about other experiences and identities. So I don't know if anybody can be really good at this without doing that. Like, you've got to put yourself around gay people. You've got to put yourself around people of color. You got to do a lot of listening. You got to like say, so, okay, I'm hearing this word a lot. You know, maybe that's something I can weave into the way I speak about it. It's that building process. Because we suffer from a lack of exposure. And we also suffer from wanting to be comfortable all the damn time.
All right, I'm jumping in because we've got three questions in less than 15 minutes. Yep. So, you're next.
Thanks.
Oh, no, she's next.
No, you're next. Thank you for being honest. Because I'm a big, fat, blue liar.
All right, good afternoon, ladies. My question is, I've seen over the years certain things change in a good way, like to support diversity and inclusion, like flexible work schedules, dress codes changing, even, you know, revamping benefits and what you choose to do as a team building event that right. more people feel included. So what do you think are some other things culturally in an organization that tend to get overlooked that would be very game changing if they were to be identified and changed?
Just closed caption stuff.
Oh, yes.
Just closed caption everything.
Yes, yes, yes.
Don't even think about it. Just do it.
Yeah.
Because if I do it for, not because of my deaf employees. I do it because I like to read while I watch, like different learning styles. Nice. Put descriptors on every single picture that you have on your website. Mm-hmm. So that people can read with a screen reader, and you can, and they can have a visual of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Literally, it's like tomorrow you could just decide to do that.
Yep.
Nice.
I would add pronoun sharing. So Wells Fargo, one of my clients, just sent out a 300,000 person wide communication saying, hey, everybody, you know, there's dialogue about going on about pronouns. We want you to know, like, this is an acceptable practice here at Wells Fargo. And we would encourage you, if you are so comfortable sharing your pronouns, et cetera. So I think that's a signal that, look, this is a safe space. I'm somebody that's not assuming everyone around me is also cisgender. I'm not making that assumption. It's kind of like heterosexism, assuming everybody's straight around you. It's cis-sexism. It's literally like, so we need, and the millennial generation's expecting this, and Generation Z is definitely expecting this. So be on that cutting edge. And with pronouns, and it's awkward. Managers will say, when do I say it? How do I say it? How do I broach the topic? Anytime you're in a new team and you're making introductions, which is common in the workplace, you know, maybe it's an ice part of the icebreaker. Hi, I'm Jennifer, really excited. We're gonna go through some great exercises. I'll let you know how I identify she, her, hers. And it doesn't even mean that anybody else has to do it. It just means, and particularly cisgender people need to do this. Mm-hmm. Particularly people of cisgender identity who have less to lose are the ones that need to do it first.
Raising my hand, because we had got that's another person, so now we have less time.
Okay.
Is she next again?
She's next.
You're so kind.
You're so honest. Hi, ladies, thanks for being here and everything you do. My name's Kim. I'm an inclusion and diversity champion, to Tiffany's point, at my factory, not big at the corporate level, so I hear everything we're saying, and I hear you sang the song to Jennifer's book. There's a process, there's stages. But I feel like if we don't move faster, if we don't go deeper faster, like, we're not going to get anywhere in 50 years. So
I know, right?
How do I balance the, we are so unaware, to we need to get somewhere?
this is where the metrics and accountability becomes really important, because we're just going to keep drinking the same Kool-Aid and doing the same dorky dance and getting nowhere. So defining those clear, measurable goals and having that accountability really matters. So, because if you lose momentum, but you've said, we're planning on having 50-50, you know, gender representation or gender parity on our board by this year, and then we get to that year and we're no closer, then we've got a real problem. So put you know, the difference between a dream and a goal is a date. Put some dates on some things, put some metrics on some things, right? Because you want to be able to look back at folks and say, what have we accomplished here? And then if you need more money, you need more time, you need more resources, you can advocate harder for what you need to get it done, because we've made it an imperative. And again, if it's not in your top three, top five at the very worst, but top three, then you might need to revamp or reconsider where it's positioned in the hierarchy.
And keep bringing it up.
So yeah. I want to jump in here, because I think this is my, like, banker mind, is that I know if I'm walking into a room with leaders and they expect me to be talking about diversity, inclusion, anything people related, they think I'm going to sing Kumbaya. And so they're waiting for my time to be over. I start with how much money I'm going to make them or save them. And so when I start with the business case, because I also teach negotiation, so I tell them what's in it for them. And then we can get to the practice stuff later. We can put the things into practice, but I got to meet them. I got to put it into a narrative that's going to be meaningful for them. Just because I'm talking, I'm going to answer the other two questions really quickly. But because I just wanted to say another thing about bias that's a quick fix or something to get people to think about is the verbs that we use. Because if I say Jennifer is a team player, but I say Tiffany performed well on her team. I said Tiffany did that. She may have just done that this one time, but by saying is a team player, I'm saying that's who Jennifer is. It's part of her DNA. And we do those kinds of things in, like, performance appraisals and thinking about leadership potentials, and people pick up on that about what is then conveyed in terms of, you know, whether it's something internal to somebody or whether it's something external that happened. And so as we think about leadership potential and promoting people, et cetera, this goes to the first question about what we can have leaders do, is one question I always ask them, why? Right, if they make a decision, why? Why did they do that? Because it gets them to hack their own decision making, and just being reflective, they can start to get at some of those biases.
Juicy.
Great.
So, awesome.
Great.
Thank you. Wisdom. All right, next, finally, the third.
Hello.
Hello.
It's nice to talk to you all. So I'm a woman in technology, but I'm not in the coder. I'm an alliance manager, so I do relationships. But I've found that doing all this stuff with diversity and inclusion, I'm more excited by that. Not that I don't like meeting new people, but how do you start to get a career in that kind of?
Congratulations, I hereby dub you diversity. Yeah, we can get double dubs.
Yeah, we can double, yes.
Double dubs, all right? So the vast majority of us are literally, we're here because we were dubbed. There are no barriers to entry. There's no certification. There's no unified standard. So you is, now, can, has, and forever will be diversity for real. So what you got to do is do the work. Just read the books, do the work. There are a bunch of universities now, back in our old days, they didn't have no certifications.
That's true.
You can get some certifications to kickstart.
Because I have my master's in technology management. So I'm
go
get some more. Okay.
To some university, get some certificate that you do over the weekends for like 4 months or something.
Yeah.
It'll make you feel better, because I don't have one of those, but you go get one for me. Okay? Tell me how that is. But just do the work. Find the organizations in your community that care about these matters.
Yeah, I'm in. I'm the chair for DC chapter.
There it is.
Of what will happen is you will get known for that. And the next time that someone has an opening on their team, they'll say, she's always been a champion. You're going to be the first person that comes to mind.
Okay. So I'm in the right direction.
You're doing it.
Okay. But I want to name some programs, though, just for you to help you.
No, that would help.
Cornell has a really great program. There's a long in-person one, and there's a short one.
I know my husband.
This program.
No, I designed the Cornell curriculum.
Oh, I'm going to go get that one.
I didn't know that.
Well, then Cornell is.
Well, damn.
Damn.
Now I want one.
So
we're all signing up now.
Yes, rock stars. So one of my consultants teaches in this program also. Teaches the whole ERG module.
I
know. You can show off now.
It was the best hair flip ever. That was the best intellectual hair flip ever. I'm not familiar with it.
That was a flex.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Okay.
What I was going to say, because I was starting to get twitchy over here, because I do think that there are some people, because it is the Wild West, people will get a certification and be like, I am a diversity professional, right? But how do you separate yourself? Right. It's not going to be that credential. So I would say in your organization or in your current role, get a project where
I'm in charge of our women's group.
And so something where you have some demonstrated results. And so people know that you're a rainmaker in that space.
Yes.
And so then your work speaks for itself. And that now distinguishes you between, you know, from the person who just has a certification to the person who has made a meaningful change.
But the first thing is, it's a head game. Start out by saying, all right, this is who I am, this is what I care about, and this is what I'm going to do.
So instead of I think I am, I am.
You are. You are now.
Oh, yeah, fake it till you make it.
There it is.
You've been knighted.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for knighting me. Thank you.
Now I have the conference. We have a couple more questions, and then we'll wrap up. So go ahead.
Sorry. I've been working in corporate America most of my professional life, and one of the things that I keep running into is the sort of, like, checklist wokeness, right? Like, we have an IND initiative. We have a women's initiative. We have these metrics. We are woke.
Right.
And so then everyone walks around and is like, well, I'm not biased. I'm good. Mm. And when you kind of come in and say, well, but you kind of are, because we all are, it just stunts the conversation, right? So it feels like there are still some companies who recognize that this is the right thing to do.
Right.
And they're doing it. And their intentions are very true. But the impact isn't being felt because it's just, check it off, we woke.
Right.
And I don't know how to overcome that, but at some point in my career, I feel like...
That's book beyond two, that. Erasing Institutional Bias, teaches you how to address
that. How do you, once you get the infrastructure set up, I guess really is the question, how do you get the momentum, and how do you reinvent that momentum when you stagnate? Because I work for a company that is stagnating. Intentions are there, everyone wants to do the things, the infrastructure is there, but we are not advancing the ball to become truly inclusive because we feel like we already did it. We did the work. Now we just meet and kind of self-congratulate each other that we
have. But are the results, do you have demonstrable, measurable results that say that you've arrived at this magical place that is inclusion?
Well, so it depends on who you talk to, right? We have a lot of gender parity in leadership, but that doesn't tell the whole story, right?
Right.
I mean, that's just one metric.
Right.
As an employee there, I can tell you no.
Right.
Right? And I don't think I'm alone in that.
So capture that.
How do you get that story out there? Okay. Culture surveys?
Totally.
That's your narrative. Like, who's telling, who? Because someone's saying the story, it's like, we're good narrative. To go, it's great. Yeah. Actually, back at the ranch, it's a hot mess, right? Like, so part of it is also, one thing that was really important for us was really getting a pulse of where people authentically and honestly felt, and that is where you gotta prepare some people for some hard truth, because they think it's awesome. When it smacks them upside the head that it's not awesome, the question is, you have to go back in front of the company and say out loud that it's not awesome, and here's what we're gonna do about it. Because there's nothing more detrimental to doing a survey around culture and about environment, a climate, I call it, right? We call it climate on campus. I call it climate at work. When you don't come back and say, here were the results and here's what we learned and we are devastated, then they won't tell the truth ever again. Yeah. You got one, maybe two chances to get that right. But that's a huge opportunity. And if they're so woke, they're expecting awesome results. Mm. Let's take that and use that to our advantage. Hey, you think it's great? Let's just ask everyone. Let's confirm it. This sounds, oh my God, that's gonna be awesome.
It's gonna be great.
Meanwhile, you're like, type in that survey. I feel safe in these spaces. I'm not covering here. Denied, negative, no. Is there a thing that's strongly disagreed with the core of my being? Yes. All that's right. What will happen.
Last question, and we gotta go. Yes?
Yes. Last right. question here.
So good.
Oh. Hi, my name is Juliana Concha. And I am wondering, so I think as a good leader, you work with your employees and your team, right, to uncover some of these biases and work through maybe potential struggles that you're having with them. As I think specifically about my team, right, like I've been able to work with my employees to work through some of those biases, but my greatest fear is like I move on and they're not enabled to then work through those biases with someone else. And so how would you recommend setting your team or people you interact with up for success so that they can then take interactions and move that forward, like no matter who they report to, work with, lead in the future?
So how, let me make sure I understand your question. How do they keep working on it beyond kind of what you do as a team?
Yes. Like, how do you enable them then to identify potential biases that may come their way? And I think I'm thinking a little differently than diversity and inclusion and maybe some of the kind of introversion, the biases towards introversion or biases towards being more technical that people may not be aware of, and how do you enable those people then to create a more inclusive environment for themselves?
I have an idea. I would connect people you care about, connect them with sponsors and mentors. So part of the way that the advice we all wish we had had was somebody who looked out for us, who saw our gifts, even if those gifts were non-traditional. Mm-hmm. And literally was like, hey, here's what this person's great at. So I think every manager should leave their team in a place where those people are going to be supported externally from the team. So if we have the seniority in the equation at your level and above, how can you make sure that each one of those people has air cover by somebody that believes in them and sees their gifts? You could do that before you go. You could literally say, I want to make sure this person, I see great things for them. Here's where they're challenged. Like, could you take them on board and make sure that they get the opportunities and they're talked about for assignments, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's all we can really do, because I think that mentoring and sponsoring is the A number one thing in terms of elevating non-traditional talent. Mm-hmm. If somebody has your back, if somebody sees your work, if somebody knows how awesome you are, and they can see beyond the organizational norms, you know, and so I think the biggest gift you could ever give someone is to use your power and your platform to make sure they're connected into the power structure, and that power structure knows who they are and is working on their behalf. That's how it works. I mean, it's kind of, and I would ask all of you, who is advocating for you in this way? Who's looking out for you? Who knows your unique gifts and is making sure that you're being discussed in meetings, and that, you know, especially if we're non-traditional in any way, we're gonna get overlooked. So this takes almost extra effort on the part of those of us that have a platform.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everyone. Let's give our panel one more round of applause.